Welcome to the Embodiment Conference 2020, also on behalf of the whole team behind the scenes. Thank you for your attention to another amazing presentation about intimacy and relationship. My name is Ilan Stefani and it's my pleasure to be sponsoring this channel, as I deeply believe that aliveness, embodiment, intimacy, relationship are key to individual and global change. My ongoing somatic research is focused on more and more aliveness for each and every one of us. I tune into the fields of collective trauma, of intimacy, of love and rage, shadow work, and higher level of energy. If you are curious about my work, you might want to catch my presentation on this channel as well as on the main stage. And you can also head over to my website, ilanstefani.com. My methods have been described as an embodiment training for warriors. However, you are so welcome to find out yourself. I teach online and in person. I teach in German as well as in English. Thank you for your attention and please enjoy the following presentation.
Thank you so much, Gary, for sharing. But this session is all about Dr. Warren Farrell and the book he co-authored with John Gray, The Boy Crisis, Why Our Boys Are Struggling and What We Can Do About It. So what we'll do right now is talk a little bit about that entire subject and dive into the book's content, but we'll also look really much at the practicals of what can be done about it, how can this be integrated, and some of the possible solutions to this crisis. I'll just intro you very briefly, Warren, and please add anything you find really important or relevant to have people know about you. And then we'll answer a few questions. So as I said, Warren is the co-author of The Boy Crisis, as you can also see in the background of his image. And he also, I really loved what I heard when I watched one of the talks that you gave. And somebody introduced you as the only man to be elected 3 times onto the board of the National Organization for Women in New York City, which says something about you and your background and your sort of work you've been doing for many, many, many years. I think there's like the dense content doesn't only cover of your book, doesn't only cover parenting and gender roles, but also looks at the greater systemic social dynamics and changes that drive the identified crisis. So we'll discuss some of these and maybe we can dive in straight by just looking at what do you even mean when you say there's a boy crisis?
When I was doing all the speaking around the world on women's issues, there would be people like teachers in Japan that would come up to me and say, you know, Dr. Farrell, it's the boys in my class that are having the biggest problems. They're falling behind, especially in reading and writing. And so I started to look at that a little bit. And then no matter which country I went to, I was getting teachers especially telling me that. And then I started getting parents telling me that. And this is back in the 70s and 80s, and when I was completely focused on the women's movement and I was, you know, all my speaking was on women's issues. And so I started that sort of, I think, put it on the radar for me. And so, you know, skipping way forward, when I finally decided to write about this in total focus form, I submitted to my publisher a proposal that incorporated 10 causes of the boy crisis. And I started to see that the 9 other causes that I mentioned were not coming, they were not the hub cause. They were not, they were outgrowths, or they were relevant when one thing was happening, and that was when a boy was dad deprived. And so for example, I saw that boys who were dad deprived and then they went to schools where they were male teacher deprived, those were boys that really got into trouble. But if they, because you know, it was like they had no male role model, and then they started to look for some sense of purpose and some way of having their testosterone channeled. And so they started looking to gang leaders or drug dealers, and which obviously was not the ideal role model. And so but boys who had dad involvement and then went to schools with all mostly female teachers and very few male role models, those boys had it wasn't ideal, but it didn't ruin their life. It didn't, you know, it didn't sort of throw them usually way off circuit if their dad was involved with them, especially if their dad was involved in something that I came to call checks and balance parenting, where the father and the mother really listened to each other and heard how important the female style, the mother style parenting was, that was usually more oriented toward protection and boundary setting, but not necessarily boundary enforcement. And the dad style parenting that had many different characteristics that I'll be happy to talk about. And those two are almost always in tension with each other. And when the father just drops out of the picture, either gets divorced or is very minimally involved, that's when you begin to have the problems. And so I started to look at, you know, I started looking at, well, all right, if there's a lack of father involvement, what's causing that lack of father involvement? And I started to see that usually it was divorces. And so the divorces, I started asking them what causes the divorces. And what I started to see was that the Achilles heel of all human beings is our inability to handle personal criticism without becoming defensive. And that no one had trained anyone to handle personal criticism from a loved one without becoming defensive, especially personal criticism that was given badly. And then I began to see that any personal criticism from a loved one is perceived as given badly. So that is, and so I then started to look at, you know, what could I do to have that factor change? And so for the last 30 years, I've been speaking all around, well, doing couples communication workshops all around the country, and starting to work on the single biggest problem, which was how do we do a workaround to the biologically natural propensity to become defensive when we're criticized. And I said biologically natural, because what I mean is historically and biologically, we were brought up in tribes or kinship networks or wherever. And if there was negative stuff coming at us, if there was criticism of our tribe or our kinship network, that was a sign of an enemy, a possible enemy. And so the people who survived are the ones that prepared themselves. They got up their defenses, or they killed the enemy before the enemy killed them. And so that, we were biologically programmed to become defensive, and that was wonderful for survival. It was just terrible for love.
Thank you, Warren. One question I have to what you just said about the criticism of our loved ones really hits us. What is the difference? Because we're talking about enemies and protection against enemies, but then our loved ones aren't our enemies. So what makes that so tricky?
It makes it tricky because we have this epigenetic trans, you know, this fear of being criticized, but that was sort of for survival purposes, obviously. But right now we have had, for the first time in human history, the last couple of generations have had the opportunity not to be role mates, but to be soulmates. But no one has been biologically prepared to be soulmates. So we all agree with it in theory. Yes, I shouldn't be as defensive as I am, but we're attacked and we become defensive. And we are sort of like angry at ourselves, ashamed at ourselves, we're angry at our partner, or when somebody is interrupted and then they're distorted, and then you try to clarify the distortion and you're interrupted and distorted again. Sometimes people reach out and hit the other one, and then, you know, and then you're down disaster lane. And so what I started to do was to say, is there a way around this? And I found that there was. But it's everything I found that I train couples to do is 100% biologically unnatural. It is biologically natural to fall in love with somebody, usually especially from the opposite sex, although not exclusively. But it's biologically natural to fall in love, but it's biologically unnatural to sustain love in a way that is really as healthy as it can be. So I started looking at what's the problem here, and the problem is that inability to handle personal criticism. So, but yet it's so important that every one of us have a chance to air our concerns and be heard. And the problem was not being heard. So I started to realize that if you want to be heard, you have to meditate into a series of mindsets that I experimented with for 30 years that allows each person to feel that the more they create a safe space for their partner to express their feelings, negative or positive, and even express it in tones of voice or frustration or distortions or exaggerations, the more you provide a safe space for all that to be said in your partner's way, the more your partner will feel they're safe with you and they can really share their soul with you. And so your partner then goes into feeling more love for you and more love because they're feeling more love from you. And so I prepare in my couples workshops for a whole series of realities to be tested. I ask each person, would you be willing to take a 50% risk of dying if you knew with 100% certainty that your partner, you could save your partner's life? And this is a workshop where maybe a third of the people are considering divorce and two thirds are there for more sort of, full enrichment reasons. But even in a workshop where a third is there for with a possible divorce in mind, about 95% of the men say, yes, I'd be willing to take a 50% risk of dying in order to save my partner's life. And about 85% of the women are willing to do that as well. And so you have, so one of the first mindsets that I ask people to think of before they hear their partner's concerns or criticisms is, if I'm willing to risk my life to die for you, maybe I'd be willing to listen to you. And after they go through a series of mindsets like that, they're in a place like, wow, no matter what my partner says, how she or he says it, if they feel safe and heard, the end result is going to be she or he is more loved and I'm more loved. And this is the same experience with gay couples, the same experience with parents and children. It really makes, I define a couple as two people who have had a history in which there's been communication issues that would like to have a future with better communication issues. But all of this said, there are things that come up during the week that, somebody makes a sarcastic comment, makes a suggestion to improve a situation, and the person who is hearing the suggestion considers it a criticism, whereas the person giving the suggestion considers it an idea to improve the relationship or an idea to improve the situation, and then the person becomes defensive to the criticism. So the other part of the couples communication workshop is, what do you do about this during the week? And so I create for my couples a conflict-free zone for 166 hours of the week and a caring and sharing time for 2 hours during the week where they do this exercise with the mindsets. But the conflict-free zone and how to maintain it is a significant part of what the couples communication workshop is about. And then, what to do that leads to that promise to keep the conflicts free, a promise that you can not only live with, but feel good about during the week.
Wow. Thank you, Warren. So we immediately went into actually the parents and the relationship of parents is crucial and core to kids growing up. But you also said that the absence of fathers in a lot of cases, especially for boys, is a major factor. Can you say a few more words about that?
Yes. So first of all, the absence of fathers, dad deprivation is a problem for both girls and boys in more than 50 areas of development. It is just significantly more intense for boys. And this is, in the Boy Crisis book, you'll see the evidence that the telomeres in the body that predict a longer or shorter life, when there's a lot of father involvement with socioeconomic variables controlled for, the telomeres manifest a greater amount of propensity to be healthy and to not ruin the genes that create that would inhibit the body from preventing cancer or heart disease. And so at the age of 9 and a half, both girls and boys who have a significant amount of father involvement have a 14% more, are likely to live 14% longer. However, the boys And the ones conversely, the ones without father involvement, a 14% shorter life expectancy. But for boys, the problem is 40% more intense. That is, boys have even less likelihood of living longer when there's a lack of father involvement. And in a way, this sort of makes logical sense. Mostly when there's a lack of father involvement, and if there's mother involvement, at least the girl has two things. One is a same-sex role model. And number two, she has much more social permission to cry and express her feelings. So she doesn't have to act out as much. Whereas boys who don't have that nearly as much permission to express their feelings, they just sort of, become belligerent, or they withdraw, or they, get into drugs, or they get into addiction to video games, or when they don't do well in school, or they become what girls might think of as losers, they turn to porn. The porn addicts them to more porn and less, and they're less desirable with girls. And so boys go down a slippery slope that is so bad that in the United States, for example, in the 21st century, there have been 5 major mass shootings of killing 10 or more people in the United States. And every single one of them has been with dad deprived boys. Overall, it's about 90% of the mass shooters, schools or non-schools, are for boys who do not have a lot of father involvement. The prisoners are 93% males in the United States. The prison population has increased 700% since the mid 70s. And those prisoners are about 85 to 90% dad deprived. And your ISIS recruits that concern us here and create a whole series of residual problems, about 85, 90% of the ISIS recruits, the boys and the girls, are dad deprived.
So if I understand correctly, it's not only a matter of the communication between parents, so if both parents are existent, but also the absence of the father is a crucial one. But yes. Then there's a third factor, which is the social expectations to boys as well in expressing and being a certain way. Yes. Can you say a bit about that? Because we've had a couple of questions coming in with regards to that. What if there is a loving father and still the boy is in crisis?
Yes. The single most important thing is, usually if there's a loving father and a loving mother and an involved mother and father, and that they're, so one of the important things is that there is, you don't have to completely refrain from arguments, but you do know, you do have to know how to solve those arguments so your boy and girl child can see that arguments are going to be solved. And so as opposed to fearing that their stability is going to be lost soon because the mother and father are really either verbally or not, or physically or both attacking each other all the time, that really scares children internally, even when the parents are together. One of my commitments in the Boy Crisis book is that every single problem that I identify, I create a solution for it. And I'd say that there's a lot of different solutions for different problems, but one of the most important ones that I've gotten good feedback on is the value of family dinner nights. Now, there's two types of family dinner nights. One is the data shows that parents that have family dinner nights, they do better. But there's a huge difference between family dinner nights and family dinner nightmares. And a lot of family dinners, they start out with, okay, this is a family dinner, you gotta get rid of your electronics. And the parents don't know how to make that happen without the whole thing starting out in a sour note. And so one of the things I talk about in the Boy Crisis is how to make that happen. But more important than that is that once that everyone gets a chance to have, for example, a couple of minutes to share what has happened with him or her during the day, or to take on a controversial topic. What do you think about the discussion of rape? What do you think about the discussion of domestic violence? What do you think? Now that sounds like, you don't want to bring that into the family, but in fact, boys love controversy as long as they have a chance to be able to share what they want to share and say what might be absurd without parental sort of eyes looking down on them, arms crossed and so on. So the job is to move around the dinner table, having everybody share whatever was the topic of being shared that day. And then as it's being shared, after it is shared with a limit on the 2 minutes, then the other one or two other people at the table say, so what I heard you say, Jimmy or Joe or my sister, brother, my mother, or my father, is that correct? Did I distort anything? And then Jimmy or Joe has the opportunity to say, yes, I do feel that that was a distortion. And Jimmy or Joe, who was just spoke, is always correct. That is, your job and the family dinner table is to keep working on your understanding of the issue that the person who is speaking brings up until that person says, yes, I feel that you got that right. And so then you move around the table. And the important thing is not just for the parents to do this for the children, but also the children to do it for their brothers and sisters and the children to do it for their parents. And so the essence of the message is what I call e pluribus unum, which is Latin for one from many. So the children are and the parents are all seeing that they can be heard, that there are many unique self-individuals in our family, but are all united by the energy of the family and the commitment of the family to hear each other and give each other the strength to feel that whatever they said it does not have to be kept to themselves. It will always be heard by the other family members without laughter or put down, or if there is laughter and put down, because we're all human, that has a chance to be brought up and discussed and as well.
Thank you so much. So basically what I hear is that the communication element is crucial, whether that's just between the couple or mm-hmm. also within the entire family. And a couple of questions came in around the topic of how does the couple's workshop and the work you do within that translate further on into like communicating with boys or teenage boys in particular? And how does that like basically affect, how do you communicate with the boys? Is there, I think you touched yes. on it now, but maybe you can say a bit more about that.
No, absolutely. So every boy, the more a boy is sort of like insecure, the more he presents his mask. I got it together. I'm strong. COVID doesn't affect me. Anything like that is very. He has to put that on. And so one of the experiences, for example, that a fellow named Ashanti Branch developed is that that you bring the boys together like teenage boys. And you have them sit around the circle, and you have them put on you give them a mask, and you say, okay, how do you present yourself to the outside world? And the guy says confident, secure, strong, but how do you present? Then the other side, how do you present? What do you really feel inside that you don't want anyone to hear? And all the boys know that nobody is going to see their mask. They don't have to put their name on it. They don't have to put anything like that on it. But then the boys fold up these masks and throw them in the center of the circle, and they mix them up, and they take each other's, pick up whatever mask they have, and they read it. And almost invariably, one of the boys says, "Yeah, that's my mask." And then when seven or eight boys have done that, everybody sees that, my goodness, everybody's covering up who they are. Everybody has these insecurities. Now, women have done a great job talking about their insecurities to other women. Men do exactly the opposite of that. We paint paint ourselves as if we have all the problems solved. And the more we do that, the more you can be assured we fear that we don't have our problems solved. And that's an extremely, that makes us extremely unsympathetic to have our problems solved, because when you're acting out, what I just shared a little while ago is, the mass shooters, are these boys without dads and that don't feel heard. The ISIS recruits, the prisoners are. So all these boys that are hurt by a lack of good communication skills and feeling secure about their insecurities, all of these boys who are hurt often hurt us, or at least boys who hurt us are almost always hurt boys.
So there's a cycle that starts and like is perpetuated. So how could we step out of that? What can be done once, for instance, a boy has grown up with all of this as a baggage? How can they reconcile their relationships with their own parents, with the world around them? Is there something that you can do even as a grown-up then?
Yes. So the first thing is to understand, and this is important for both dads and moms, to understand what is the importance of father involvement. So if, for example, I'll give you an example. So 9 out of 10 times, the person who's more likely to do roughhousing in a family is the dad. And so the dad might do something like, okay, kids, they have 3 kids, let's say, and like, throw the 3 kids on the couch. And your job is to pounce on my back and to pin me down and before I pin the 3 of you down together. Okay, dad, oh, great. And the kids get ready to do the pouncing, and mom's going, oh my God, I feel like I have just one more child to monitor here on the dad. And the mother is saying, oh, but the kids are laughing. They seem like they're going to have fun. They're looking forward to this. I don't want to interfere. I don't want to be controlling. But I just, in the back of my mind, my intuition says that sooner or later, somebody's going to get hurt. I really fear that, but I don't want to interfere. About 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, 15 minutes later, she's proven to be about 99.9% of the time, she's likely to be right. And so somebody gets hurt. And then dad goes, and mom goes, okay, at least I knew it. Now I'm feeling a little bit guilty that I didn't interfere and didn't pay attention to my intuition. And I've let the children be hurt. I feel badly about that. But at least now dad will learn and I didn't have to interfere. That's good for me. But then dad goes ahead and says, okay, Jimmy, you can't put your elbow into Jane's face. That's not okay. And if you do that, we're going to stop, the roughhousing. And so mom's going, wait a minute. You've just seen that this roughhousing leads to the kids getting hurt. And now you are going back and doing it again. And you think that because you tell the kids that, that they can't stick their elbow in their sister's eye in order to win, that they're going to listen to you. Well, they go back and mom is just like, now I really do know I have just one more child to monitor. And so now she's feeling a little bit more caught and giving warnings like, don't hurt them. It's, blah, blah. And so, and dad goes back to the roughhousing. And once again, mom is right. One of the kids gets hurt. And so, and then dad says, okay, you did exactly what the opposite, what is not said here is what the kids are experiencing is what psychologists call emotional intelligence under fire. They've made a promise intellectually to not be aggressive push somebody aside. But then when they get all caught up and under fire, they're excited, they forget about their promise, usually. But then dad goes ahead and says, okay, I told you couldn't do that. Oh, we didn't do that. It wasn't too rough. Yes, that was too rough. Here's what too rough is. And so we're going to stop roughhousing tonight and we'll pick it up again tomorrow night, but no more roughhousing. And tomorrow night, the roughhousing will stop as soon as you do something like this or that. And so mom is again like, you really are pretty dense and not learning your lesson. But it's the next night that the payoff comes. And the next night when dad says, you can't be too aggressive or you can't use your elbow, et cetera, the kids know now they're under fire, but they have a different type of internal dialogue, which is if I don't remember the dad's instructions to be assertive but not aggressive, I'm gonna lose what I really want. I'm gonna lose my roughhousing. So what the kids are learning is a number of the most important things. One is postponed gratification, that they really want to just be as rough as possible and push the other person out of the way. But if they're going to get what they want, the roughhousing, they've got to postpone the gratification of immediate gratification of pushing their sister or brother out of the way. And they've got to learn the difference between being assertive and aggressive. And they've got to think of their sister's or brother's needs. And so the data shows us that children that do roughhousing with their dads are far more empathetic than children who don't. They're also better able to distinguish between being aggressive versus assertive. And of course, kids that are more empathetic and that are less aggressive, they get along, they have many more friends at school. Kids that have postponed gratification are able to complete things rather than get distracted. Kids that have postponed gratification are far less likely to have ADHD. And so they do better in school. They can focus on doing whatever their dream is. So therefore, their teachers admire them more. Their peers admire them more. When it comes to boy-girl time, girls date, as I was mentioning before, girls date winners, not losers. And so they're much happier. They're much more integrally connected. But dads don't know this. Because there is almost, you know, when I did the research for the boy crisis, I didn't find any parenting magazine that explained these differences. And so dads don't know this from the parenting magazines, if they do read them, and many don't even read them. And moms can't hear what dads don't say. And so everyone's sort of left in this lurch of feeling like, you know, dad is just another child, and dad feeling unable to articulate what he is unwittingly doing, because I've never heard a dad say, "Oh, sweetie, I want to roughhouse with the kids to make them more empathetic," because that's not what motivates him predominantly. But he does sort of intuit that, but he rarely does this. And this type of difference happens with teasing. It happens with taking adventures, camping, how many risks physically you're likely to take. Can you climb the tree, not climb the tree? All of these have to be, the father and the mother have to be able to communicate with each other so that when they have a disagreement, they understand that their disagreement is not a sign that they don't belong together and therefore divorce. It is a sign that they need to hear each other and work out some win-win situation from that. No, the kids can climb the tree, says the mother. Yes, they should be able to climb the tree, says the dad. What do you want to protect them out of, you know, out of anything? They have a big argument and realize, well, wait a minute, maybe we can negotiate this. They can climb the tree, but only up to a certain point and not these branches. And you've got to be out there under the tree in case they fall, so they don't have a major problem concussion-wise, et cetera. And so then the kids get the best of both worlds. But dads need to know that climbing the tree is not just climbing the tree. It increases your psychomotor functioning, which increases your IQ to be able to do things like climb that tree, knowing what risks to take, what risks not to take. But again, I found it took me 14 years to find this research for the boy crisis to be able to help dads and moms communicate with each other with substance, not just the method of the couples communication workshop.
So that addresses mostly how fathers can function as like figures to set boundaries and also help boys especially grow up to understand experientially what the consequences of certain actions are, and therefore you said build more empathy, build more skills, and mm-hmm. so on and so forth. And the awareness of that for fathers is crucial. What in cases where you said, yes, systemically, we have that problem of so many absent fathers, and that's not only because the father isn't there at all, which is also the case in so many families, but what about fathers who work late? What about if there's no possibility that the father can actually be present? How can mothers do some of that?
Yes, well, first of all, mothers can do that. There's a school called Urban Dove in New York, which takes people who are kids that are not doing well in school. They're slated to drop out of high school. There's everybody considers them having no chance of graduating from high school, and the first 2 hours of the day that they're in school, both male and female teachers do physical activities with them. And then at the end of those 2 hours, they go to academic classes. And the coaches during those 2 hours, they don't go on and coach other people. They follow the kids around to the classes so that if the kids need help in algebra or language or whatever, the coach can support the teacher to say something like, you know, remember how we taught you how to defeat the other team, and you really treated them as something that you could really get your energy together and do. So both mothers of just both female and male teachers do this. Those kids have about a 90% graduate level and going to college, and about 8% of the remaining 10% go on to like a technical school after high school. These were kids that were, you know, that were on a path to self-destructiveness. And so that's really important to understand that women, boundary setting versus boundary enforcement. Boundary setting comes very naturally to moms, but there's a difference between boundary setting and boundary enforcement. So for example, both moms and dads are usually very good about saying something like, "Oh, sweetie, you can't have your ice cream until you finish your peas." And kids are excellent at trying to have as few peas as possible before they have their ice cream. They're pretty much 100% there. But the next stage, is that when the child tries to manipulate fewer peas for the ice cream more immediately, the mom is more likely to be much more empathetic to something that might have happened to the child during the day that wasn't very, that made the child disappointments. Maybe they got into a fight or were bullied or whatever, or the mother is feeling guilty that there's a divorce or that dad isn't home, et cetera. And the child begins to intuit after a while how she or he can manipulate the mom to eating fewer peas before they have the ice cream. The dad is much more likely to say, no matter what the situation is, "I'm sorry, we have a deal here. The deal here is you can't have your ice cream until you finish your peas." So the child will often go something like, "You are so mean. Mom lets me do this. You know, and doesn't always force me to have all the peas, especially when I've had this type of thing happen at school." And dad goes, "I understand, but you still can't have your ice cream until you finish your peas." "You're still so mean." Well, you can still keep raging like that. And then tomorrow night, there won't be any ice cream either. And then the kid says, "Oh dear, I have a choice. I either don't get the ice cream or I do. So I need now to focus my attention on finishing the peas, finishing them before I get the ice cream." And so that boy is boys raised by dads, only 15% of them have ADHD. Boys raised by moms, 30% have ADHD. And one of the differences you can see in that example is the child raised by the mom learns how to focus on a better manipulation to get before she or he finishes. The child raised by dads is more likely to have to focus his or her attention on what she or he needs to do. And instead of getting attention deficit disorder, they have attention focus. Now, sometimes the mother is the one that is the boundary enforcer, and the dad is the one that is, gets his, maybe his daughter can wrap him around his finger, or he comes home and he wants to be the good guy, and so on. And so there's many exceptions to this rule, but this generally is the pattern that creates a lot of problems an example of the pattern that creates a lot of problems in many relationships. And so it's so important for both mother and father to see, what is the genetic heritage that led to moms doing this? What is the positive value of that? How can we get the best of the positive value of what moms do with the boundary setting without losing the boundary enforcement, and understanding that when a mom or dad sets a boundary and doesn't enforce it, that develops a contempt or disrespect for the parent that leads the child to really not feel secure that she or he knows where those boundaries end.
So in another way, could one parent take on both roles? Because if we have the case of like single parents, could someone just take both roles, or is that not really possible?
So first of all, a parent who is a single parent, there's a lot of things a single parent can do to take on both roles. But there are things that are usually missing that are challenges. So the best way to take on both roles is to really understand, the best way to do it is in a way not to do it. And here's what I mean by that. The best way to do it is to really do your reading about what dads contribute and how they contribute. With this understanding in mind, when men feel they are needed, they almost always are willing to come forth. And so in every generation historically, for example, had its war. And during those wars, we said, Uncle Sam needs you, or the government said you are needed to. And what were men willing to do? They were willing to internalize their masculinity as being able to be manifested by being willing to be disposable. Masculinity almost always was associated with disposability at war or disposability at work. But the big communication here is that if a man is willing to die in order to feel needed, then if you're telling him he's needed, he is willing to do an enormous amount to come back and help and be helpful as long as he feels he's valued. But if he only feels he's valued for the money he makes, then he will experience the father's catch-22, which is to learn to get the love of the family by being away from the love of the family. Taking a job that earns more, that is less fulfilling to him, until his soul begins to sort of be, I really wanted to teach in elementary school, but when we had three children and my wife decided that she wanted to be home with those three children or only work part-time, I needed to become a superintendent of schools or a principal. I hate administration. I hate dealing with all those conflicts. I'm made for the classroom, but I have to give that up. And then we look at that and say, oh, more men are principals or superintendents of schools. That must be discrimination against women. When in fact, the man is feeling that it's discrimination against him, but he never expresses that because men don't talk about that way. They don't say, I feel like a victim. That's not male talk. And so these types of things are part of what we need to, the first thing is to get the man back in the picture by valuing him. However, there are places, times, and you know, I'll take you to one example of how powerful this is. I ran for governor of California against Schwarzenegger some years ago, 2003. And so as part of the campaign, I spoke at prisons around the state. And so and almost all these prisoners were themselves dad deprived. And they almost all were ashamed of themselves, feeling that they'd screwed up their life and they were the loser in the family. And when I shared with them how and why dads were so important, these prisoners, muscles, tattooed, that stick a finger in your face and tell you how terrible you are, would come up and say to me, and crying in tears and saying, I always thought I was the terrible one, and that if anything, I should be here, and I was, I'm worthless to my family. And what you've helped me see is that I have a lot that I can contribute, and maybe the reason I am the way I was is because I didn't have a role model that was constructive. I want desperately now to do everything I can to make my prison term as short as possible and get back home to make sure my children don't develop the problems that I had, and I can give them strong, firm guidance and play with them and bond with them and do the things that are necessary. Okay, so I've given you that part of how to involve the dad and how important it is and what the main motivation for men is. So let me address and work with the mothers, for example, who just, there's no way, shape, or form the dad can come back for whatever reason. So some of the most important things you can do is, if your country has the equivalent of Cub Scouts, in the United States, we have very good data on the importance of Cub Scouts to develop better character for those children that are involved two or more years and attend frequently. Second, faith-based communities. No matter what your faith is, it really doesn't make any difference if two things are happening. Number one is you go to a faith-based leader and you make sure that it's a good, a positive male leader that really connects well with the children, not one that gives good sermons, but one that connects with the people who don't make the contributions to the church, that is your son. but particularly watch for the ones, the faith-based leaders who get boys that your son's age in a group. And in that group, talking with other boys, they get each of the boys to be able to confidentially, and the word confidentially is in all caps, confidentially be able to share with each other what their real feelings and fears are. The moment boys think that they might be tattled about or talked about outside of the group is the moment they will shut up. That's why confidentially is so important. That gives boys both a faith, which is oftentimes a helpful strength of God the Father or some equivalent thereof to help replace the loss of the father. I was speaking to a church in Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn, which is one of the poorest communities in Brooklyn. And after I spoke, the Reverend took me in the back, and there were 25 boys there. And I talked to them about their backgrounds. 20 of those boys had been in prison. And one of the boys said, and if I didn't believe in Jesus Christ as Savior or in God the Father, and plus the devotion of the Reverend to pay attention to me and talk to me about my problems and express faith in me about what I could do in life, I would be still doing everything that I used to do that got me into prison. So I said, well, is that true with any of the other boys? And we went around, and the 20 out of the 25 boys who had been in prison, every single one of them said that was true. So this again was a reverend who was really conscious about this, who got together boys with other boys. And so that's another thing that you can do. Third is make sure you get your son involved in what I call the liberal arts of sports. Team sports are most important. Pick-up team sports are almost as important, where kids learn to make their own rules and choose their own friends and enforce those rules without a supervisor doing it. Very important, especially if you want to prepare your boy to be an independent entrepreneur. And then third, individual sports where you have to be self-starting. And those three sports, that what I call the Boy Crisis book, the liberal arts of sports, are each have a very important developmental power for boys and for girls, by the way. Almost all these things are very good for girls to do also. And as I said, the girls also have problems in all 50 of these developmental areas, just not as powerfully as the boys do.
Thank you, Warren. So what I gathered from that is it's really about having that positive role model. And if it doesn't exist in the nuclear family, then to find outside, and that could be coaches, teachers, or as you said, a church. So it doesn't need to, but it could be also the what you said now was the church replaced some of the maybe the purpose finding or the connection to something bigger. And I know you addressed that in your book as well, that there's this like lack of purpose oftentimes that also contributes to the boy crisis, and that thereby it can play out in negative ways, seeking out certain unhealthy ways of finding a bigger purpose for yourself, which might lead to joining a cult, joining a gang, as you already said in the beginning. Want to add something?
I'll explain that purpose void a bit more so it makes more sense. Historically, there's good news and bad news here. Historically speaking, I mentioned before that every generation had its war, and that we called boys up and males up to serve in that war if we really were honoring them. And so boys felt the sense of purpose. I can, yes, I may die, but at least, Uncle Joe is a Marine and he died in war, and the whole family admires him for his service and so on. I at least can have that type of honor and recognition. Or alternatively, historically, boys would learn that if I don't go to war, even if I don't go to war, at least I can be the sole breadwinner, and and that's my purpose. But now we need fewer boys in wars in most countries, not all of them, and women are sharing the burden of economically producing for the family to a much greater degree than they used to. So the good news is we have fewer boys die in war, and fewer boys feel so pressured to earn all the money at work. The bad news is those were old purposes, and now there's a purpose void. And so when you have this purpose void, you have this enormous opportunity, which is a mother and father together can help the child discover, you know, what's his personality or her personality, and how does that create an opportunity for that child to be a wonderful singer, you know, a good teacher, whatever her or his passion is. And so, but without a father involved, usually the mother is really good at sensing what the child's strengths are and encouraging the child to pursue her or his dream. But a child often, a father often contributes that boundary enforcement that it requires the child to, I'm sorry, you didn't finish your home. You got a B rather than an A. There's no, you know, I'm taking this away from you and it's not coming back until you get a report card that comes up with an A. And so the child tends to learn with the father more discipline, more boundary enforcement, more postponed gratification. So when you have both the mother and father working together on that postponed gratification, you usually have a child that doesn't only dream, but is able to fulfill their dreams and therefore get the respect of others and get the respect of themselves. And so, and also to help discover the purpose of that individual child, rather than just have every child who's a male have to march to the old purpose of acting like a big, strong male who's not afraid of dying and keep all the feelings to themselves and the fears to themselves. And so we have an entire new experience happening, this purpose void. But when we don't have a family to help the children both develop their sense of uniqueness combined with the discipline to create, to manifest that sense of uniqueness, we often have a child that can't discover a new purpose and then have the discipline to fulfill it.
Thank you for elaborating a bit more on purpose. I would like to, we have about 5 minutes left now. This went so quick.
It did.
I would like to touch, yes. And I know there's so much more you could share with us. And I already want to throw it out here. There's some lovely even talks and presentations Warren did that are available to watch on YouTube. And I'd really recommend checking those out. They speak a bit more about also gender and how the ideas of masculinity, femininity, and the powers involved in that play out and how that can be addressed, reversed, and sort of explored. So definitely check that out. We'll post the links on the Facebook group as well and into, maybe not into this chat, but I'll make sure that it's available as well. I would love to throw in a question that is very timely though, which is when all of this isn't available currently due to COVID, because there's so many restrictions on getting involved in movement and team sports and all of that. Do you have recommendations how that could be sort of buffered?
Yes, be involved. Well, first of all, getting the father involved is in a way more important because the father can take the child out and play basketball with the child or play, you know, some type of sport and bond with the child that way. The father with the mother can take the child camping and have the dialogue with the mother of, no, it's okay for the child to walk down to the lake. Well, wait a minute, you have to be with our son. No, I'll let the son get out of sight. There's enough place in the lake place between here and the lake to find him if he gets lost. But suppose he gets lost. Yes, suppose he gets lost. We'll eventually find him. Let him make the decisions that to know how to protect himself. This is the, and again, this is not the right answer. This is the answer that should be in dialogue with moms. We have to also recognize that we're really focused on and help. We've had a wonderful, wonderful period of history where we're saying Black Lives Matter. But we are doing something absolutely inadequate for Black lives, which is 73% of Black families do not have their father involved in any significant way. And it's in that portion of Black families where there is by far and away the greater amount of prisoners and so on. And so we need to have a whole father warrior, WARRIOR. You were talking about the warriors at the beginning of the introduction of this. The new warrior that we have to have is not a warrior who goes out and kills and is killed, but a warrior who is trained from early years to love and be loved. So our classrooms need to focus on how do boys and girls communicate? How do they hear each other? How do they learn not to be bullies? And not just for the purpose of not being bullies, but preparing the mentality internally for that boy to eventually know that that he will be honored by being a father warrior and preparing for that at an early age, and that to be a babysitter or help his little brother be protected or guided or play ball with him has a great purpose that's going to be rewarded and honored. And so we have to, and if we do that, we'll help all families do better, but we'll be particularly helpful to the African American community, and then we can say that we care. That if we care, we're being very disingenuous if we say Black lives matter and we are ignoring the fact that Black fathers matter. We have to call our Black fathers and our Caucasian and Hispanic fathers and fathers from all backgrounds to the home and say, we will honor you for being at home. And that means a different communication to girls too. Girls, instead of just saying, oh, this guy's a CEO or he's a movie star or a celebrity, I really feel wonderful marrying him, saying, oh, this man wants to be a full-time dad. I'd feel wonderful about marrying him.
Wow, some powerful messages in here, Warren. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Pleasure to talk with you.
So unfortunately, we have to wrap this up. But as I mentioned already, there's so much more content and speeches and your book out there to really look more in depth into this, also workshops and other ways. And maybe you have other recommendations you could send to me that I could make available for people looking to improve their parenting or their communication. Because what I took away from our conversation now really is open dialogue and communication are at the core of all of it. So even if you might have fucked up as a parent until your son was a teenager or young man, still this might be an option to open up like a dialogue and open communication about this.
It is never too late to hear a child. And it's amazing the amount of healing that is done when that happens. And the children really need their parents and parents really need their children. If somebody, the communication issue, I'm prepared, COVID has given me the opportunity to prepare a Zoom couples communication course. I'm going to be making this available for only a fraction of what my course normally is, it costs, but I will also be working on getting funding to distribute it for free to communities that are poor and to libraries and faith-based communities and so on. So I want to get this out there in a way that communication is never prevented from happening in families. And so if you want to go to my website, warrenferrell.com, it's my email is on there, which is just, you know, warren@warrenferrell.com. And just email me, say you'd like to learn about that course when it's available in about 4 months from now. And if you don't have the money, let me know that, and we'll figure out a way of getting it to you for free.
Amazing. Thank you. That's very generous and needed. So I would like to come back with one final question we ask all our presenters, which is how to the top tip of staying embodied. I'll leave you with that to think about for a couple of minutes while I announce a few things. We have posted a few links in the chat right now as well. If you feel like you want to exchange and share about anything that you discovered in this talk or in other presentations you've watched throughout the conference, please join one of our coffee breaks. There are Zoom meetings where you can dialogue with other people who've attended sessions. Also, if you want to engage a little more with this channel, there is a Facebook group that has a little bit more exchange on it. And we also stream these sessions there live, which is also, there's a link in the chat box right now. And then last but not least, if you feel like, wow, this is such rich content, there's so many sessions also addressing topics that are very linked and relevant to this very one, consider upgrading. Spare yourself the stress of like needing to get it all in within the little time period we offer to watch these sessions for free. Get the recordings and have them for life. So the link for that is also in the chat, and you'll be additionally also supporting this entire project and other people who cannot afford maybe purchasing. So if you have the financial means, we are trying to make it available for free, but we also need to cover costs to run this event. So if you have an abundance, consider that to support what we're doing here. And then, Warren, back to you. What is your top tip to staying?
The top tip is to never underestimate the value of fathers and family. And to this is something I had no idea how important it was until I started doing the research on this. And then particularly, if you're in the family that's earning $50,000, $60,000 a year or enough to just get by, to live with a food and a home over your head, from that point on, dad's time is worth more than dad's dime. And so, and then I guess the second thing would be to understand that we're all in the same family boat. We've often say that this sex is better than that sex or this, you know, but when only one sex wins, both sexes lose.
Thank you so much, Warren. It was a real honor having you on the conference.
It was a total pleasure having you be so thoughtful in your questions and listening so well and being part of a larger spiritual network that is making everybody's lives better.
Thank you so much. And we'll see you somewhere, I hope.
Yes.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.